This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The executive director of the Food Bank Council of Michigan recently wrote a column titled "Hunger is Not Inevitable." Coming up, Philip Knight tells us why hunger can be tackled in Michigan. But first, a new study is recommending that 1,400 housing units be developed over the next 5 years in the city of Kalamazoo, specifically in and around the city's downtown. The study was prepared by Zimmerman Volk Associates for several entities in Kalamazoo and statewide. Andrew Hahn is Associate Director for the Governor's Office for Urban Initiatives. Andrew Hahn, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So explain why this study was done in the first place. What are we looking at here?
Well, I think we've seen both nationally and across Michigan, there's a huge demand for new residential housing. You've got millennials and boomers all wanting to move into, or many wanting to move into downtown areas, walkable areas, downsize. You know, you have millennials that are purchasing cars in lower numbers than they had in the past, you know, than Gen X and boomers had. And we wanted to quantify that. So, you know, anecdotally, I think everyone kind of knew this, but from the state side, we want to make sure that we're investing in the right projects and helping our local partners make sure they're investing in the right projects too. So wanted to be able to quantify what that demand was.
Okay, understanding here that this is not necessarily your sandbox that we're talking about in terms of how this research was done, but give us some ideas of what people are looking at to reach the ultimate conclusion of new housing being needed.
Sure. So typically, a lot of market studies are done by looking at the occupancy rate of the product that is in the market today. So this methodology is a little bit different in that it goes by looking at census data, in-migration and out-migration, and the various demographic groups that make that up, and is able to look at the purchasing patterns of these folks, various income levels, and then project from, you know, the national data what types of housing these demographics are looking for.
So if we look at the people who we think might be interested in housing in and around downtown, are they different demographically than the city as a whole, people who, you know, live further out, or the county as a whole, for that matter?
And, you know, I wouldn't say they're different. They're part of that mix that you have throughout the county. If you look at general trends nationally, you have a lot of millennials that are looking to live in these downtown areas. They are now the biggest generation in the country. It's no longer the baby boomers. But at the same time, you have a lot of boomers that are wanting to downsize, that their kids are out of the house, they're empty nesters, they don't want the 1 acre lawn anymore to mow, and really want to have that that interaction that having a walkable neighborhood feel can provide you, with a little more access to amenities, arts and culture and dining and all that, and a little bit more of a neighborhood and community feel.
So are there conclusions in this report about what the mix should be of housing that people rent and housing that people buy?
Yeah, you know, interestingly, in the post-recession era, the purchasing of condos and downtown units, that's still not really rebounded. And you've seen, not just in Michigan, but in other areas, a lot more demand for rental units. People are more mobile, they're moving more often, and demand for rental units is much higher. So in the study, the numbers, I can't recall exactly what the number is, but the mix is really heavily tilted towards rental units. And then it's broken out by all those different types of product as well. There's a lot that you don't see in Michigan that, for example, you know, brownstones, there's not very many of those, live-work units, the various types of lofts that are in pretty limited supply anywhere in Michigan, and particularly in Kalamazoo, you don't see a lot of those products. So the study actually lays out projected numbers that could be absorbed into the market of all those different product types.
Would 1,400 housing units necessarily come from new construction? Could there be some rehabilitation, conversion of existing buildings that could also move that number along?
It could absolutely move it along. I think I would say that Kalamazoo in particular has done a great job of rehabbing their existing buildings and their historic buildings. there's been a handful of developers that have been doing that for, you know, maybe a decade, and there's not a tremendous amount of capacity for, you know, upper floor unused space to be converted, but there's definitely, you know, I would say several dozen units that could come from that type of a mix.
Would new housing have an affordability aspect? Would people who don't necessarily make a ton of money be able to find some place to live either in downtown or close to it under what they're spelling out in this study?
Yeah, so within the study, it actually projects of the 1,400 units that we keep referencing, about 1,000 of those would be market rate units. And then there's also a demand for, you know, 400 workforce units is the new way that they're often being referred to, low to moderate income units, however you want to say it. But I think there's, you know, there certainly is a demand across different demographics and income levels, and a really great opportunity, particularly in Kalamazoo, to build for those different income levels and make sure that you really have a diverse urban core.
How do you mandate, you know, low to moderate income? Does that require some sort of action by the public sector to put, you know, limits on the amount you can charge for rent and that sort of thing?
You know, that's not something that has been seen in Michigan. I certainly don't want to speak to local policy decisions, but I think there are a lot of opportunities for developers to take advantage of various incentives and programs from, you know, the federal, state, and local government to do that. I think there's an opportunity to cast a vision for what you'd like to see. And I think from all the discussions I've heard, that certainly is, you know, to have that broad mix of demographics, income levels, et cetera.
You mentioned earlier the idea of walkability, being able to get around and having certain types of institutions nearby, arts and cultural and those sort of things. Is that a big component here of more housing, is that you want people to be able to still enjoy those things? In other words, you want to do this smartly so that the housing is built in a way that allows people to still have a downtown experience?
Yeah, I certainly would say so. You know, and I think maybe to back up a little bit, walkability is a term that is often mixed up because there's two complementary yet differing definitions of that. And one really speaks to your infrastructure as far as if something is, you know, safe to be walkable. You know, are there sidewalks? Where are the curb cuts? You know, are the streets safe to cross? And then you have this idea of the more amenity-focused definition. There's a thing, something called Walk Score out there right now, which is able to measure all of the different amenities that a neighborhood has or a downtown has, and rank that on a scale of 1 to 100. And that looks at everything from if there's a grocery store to the various services that a resident would need, dry cleaners, hair salons, childcare, et cetera. Are there restaurants, are there coffee shops that are walkable and it would allow you to not be truly dependent on the car 100% of the time? And that really is where we're seeing more of the demand. So I believe 40% of people that are looking for a new home, and I think this is across all demographics, 40% are looking for a place in a walkable downtown or walkable neighborhood. In Michigan, only 8% of the product that we have is considered walkable across the state. And only 2% of the product built after 1960 is considered walkable. So there really is a great opportunity in the market there.
And is the vision kind of maybe that is being laid out in this study that there is an area where you can walk to many of those things, the coffee shop, the restaurant, the dry cleaner, et cetera. The goal now is to find a way to get more housing where people can live in that area so that they can do the walking.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the more people you get, you know, if, say, for instance, if this 1,400 units were to be realized, that would be, you know, rough estimate here, probably 2,000 or 2,500 people moving into this area. And if you put 2,000 new people into an area, there's going to be new businesses and services that follow too. So I think that's an opportunity that's important to not overlook.
You mentioned that this is becoming something that people want to look at in several areas, not just in downtowns, but maybe even in more suburban settings. Is the feedback perhaps that you have the combination of an older generation, which may be nearing the time that they don't drive, but they still live independently. And then, as you noted earlier, the younger generation, which would just rather not be burdened as much with the idea of a car payment, car repairs, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. We haven't seen that trend of the suburbs urbanizing or becoming more walkable a great deal yet in Michigan. We are seeing it in other major metros, and I think that is also a great opportunity, you know, to have your housing in your suburban areas closer to the amenities that you have, and to have that mix of product, you know, where it's not all single family homes and subdivisions that you have to walk out to your main arterial road that may or may not have a sidewalk and, you know, be a mile or more from, you know, from all the amenities. So I think that also is a big opportunity.
So if everyone reads this study and agrees, yes, 1,400 new units of housing is the way to go for downtown Kalamazoo and some of the neighborhoods which are close to downtown. What does that mean next? What's the next step in that process?
Well, I did a quick estimate, and of that 1,400, there's already either recently announced or in the pipeline over 300 units on the way. So, you know, that 1,400, as you said, is over 5 years. So I think we've already got a good start on that. You know, I think there's great opportunity for education and communication to the development community about the opportunities that there are for this type of product, to the lending and financial institutions that maybe have not financed projects like this or product like this, so that they understand that there's a market there, to municipal partners, not just in Kalamazoo, but certainly across the state, so that they do have, you know, zoning and plans that reflect what the market really wants, and maybe aren't tied to development patterns of 40 or 50 years ago. So, I mean, it's really got to be a broad outreach, you know, growing the bench of developers is something that we think there's an opportunity for. I mean, if you have small business owners that maybe have two or three floors of undeveloped space, but wouldn't know the first thing to do with how you do a multi-layered financing deal or even start to do a project, helping those folks understand next steps, helping someone that maybe is a small developer or a home builder get into doing some of these small projects is an opportunity too.
Is making a downtown for the city the size of Kalamazoo, which is, you know, 75,000, maybe, you know, somewhere between 75 and 80,000, is that something that the state wants to see a little bit more of, that cities that size can have a vibrant downtown where people can live and they can walk and they can have a lot of those things? And yet, you know, we're not talking about a city that's going to grow into the size of Grand Rapids or anything else like that.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's certainly opportunities for places like Kalamazoo to, you know, to grow not only population, but also their economic impact and reach. You know, you said 75 to 80,000, you're right. But when you look at a countywide and then you start looking at your metro, the size of your metro, I mean, Kalamazoo serves, you know, 250,000 people and really is that core, you know, and across the state, if you look at the 14 major metros within the state, you know, 82% of the population is within those metropolitan areas, 84% of the jobs, 86% of the GDP, 85% of exports. I mean, the list goes on. So really it is our metropolitan areas that drive the economy of the state. So, and our urban core cities are the heart of those metros. So I think we realize there's great opportunity to further leverage those assets.
Andrew Hahn, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Andrew Hahn is Associate Director of the Governor's Office for Urban Initiatives. A link to the study calling for more housing units in and around downtown Kalamazoo can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. In a recent op-ed column that ran in the Battle Creek Inquirer and other newspapers in the state, Food Bank Council of Michigan Executive Director Philip Knight says eliminating hunger is a big job, but he says it can and should be done. Knight says there is a clear and moral mandate for no child, senior, or anyone in between to go hungry in Michigan. Philip Knight, thank you very much for being with us.
Gordon, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You say that the Food Bank Council of Michigan and your statewide network of member food banks, which of course includes the one in South Central Michigan based in Battle Creek, are, in your words, finished being bullied by hunger. Is this the start, then, of a new approach statewide?
I think so, Gordon. I think that we have come to the place where we realize that the resources are available for us in this state, and the political will seems to be mounting. And I think that we have an opportunity that's unprecedented in our state to really take hunger on and see if we just can't make everyone in our state food secure.
Let's begin by defining our terms here. You note that 23% of the people in Michigan are food insecure. What exactly does that mean?
In 2014, Feeding America did a hunger study in just a very few states. One of those is Michigan. And what we found was that 16% of Michiganders are considered food insecure, both in urban, rural, and suburban areas. Wayne County, for example, has an insecurity rate of 23%. And 18% of seniors across the state are food insecure. And that simply means that whether they're children or seniors or anyone in between, they're not sure they have enough food, access to enough food for another meal.
But there could also be people in there who are literally going hungry on a daily basis, getting little or no food over a day or two.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, Gordon, it made me think differently about snow days in Michigan. So if we have a snowstorm on Saturday or Sunday and school doesn't open on Monday, that's the third day in a row, another day that a child didn't have enough food to eat because they're so dependent on the meals that they're able to get through the school system.
So why do you think the conditions are right at this particular time to take on a problem, which you acknowledge is a big problem to take on?
It is a big problem. So there's a couple of factors, I think, that are working for us. The Food Bank Council of Michigan recently went through a strategic planning process, and part of that process was gathering all of our assets together. And we looked at the work, the collective work of the seven food banks across the state. We realized that we were making a tremendous impact. Now there seems to be some mounting of political will to take this issue on. I'll give you an example. And the Michigan Health Endowment Fund has written grants that will go right after hunger in its entirety, including nutrition. You know, the problem with hunger is it's the only problem you have if you have that. You don't worry about education. You don't worry about health insurance. You don't worry about other problems in life if you're hungry. And when you're hungry, if you only... you'll eat whatever's given to you. You'll eat whatever you can find. And sometimes those choices aren't very healthy. And so this political will has mounted with a Michigan Health Endowment Fund where we're leading a project across the state to not only ensure people have access to food, but they have access to nutritionally valued food.
So is this part of the effort to get at what are called food deserts?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that what we're finding, too, is this idea of collaboration is becoming more than a buzzword, more than a trend. It's becoming a value for people who are doing work with people, trying to help them, whether they be with the state office or they're in the nonprofit sector or the for-profit who's supporting so much of the work. How can we work together to solve the problem and meet the need rather than just everybody continue to work in silos?
What changes would you want to make at the level of public policy in the state if there is going to be some sort of grand effort on multi-levels to get at the problem of hunger?
We found that the administration and the legislatures both have been very receptive to us in our message about that we can really, as Steve Jobs said, we can go out and make a dent in the world. We can really put a dent in hunger. We can stop using words like alleviate, and let's talk about it in terms of eliminate. And that seems to have really caught the attention of some people and decision makers, so much so that the Food Bank Council of Michigan, we have a line item in the state budget for a MAS program. It's called the Michigan Agricultural Surplus System. And what that allows us to do, Gordon, is buy Michigan produce only, and that's the produce that farmers can't sell. It's their seconds. Perfectly good produce, but the top sellers, the top buyers are not going to take that. So we're able to buy this produce and put that through our food bank system and distribute it across. And we found amazing support for this program throughout the administration, the legislature, the state departments, as well as our farmers.
Food waste is part of what we're getting at here. There's a lot of food that can be eaten, but for whatever reason isn't, and you're looking to find a different way to put it to good use in Michigan.
That's exactly right. Very well said. There is more than enough food in our state to feed our state.
You say in your column that you have to start by manufacturing the personal and political will. As we speak right now, do you see that political will is growing, and has it reached the point yet that this can really take on the issue of hunger?
You know, I think momentum's always either working for us or against us, and I see the momentum building toward hunger. And some of the great work that is being done around the state through some of our partners, and I think it's a new day for us in Michigan, and I see that day coming where we're going to be able to say that everyone has access to food. They're secure in this area.
One of the things you also tell us is that there are more pounds of food being delivered by the various food banks across the state, including the one of South Central Michigan based in Battle Creek, than at any time in the history of the state food bank council. Why is that when we keep hearing that our economy is getting better both in Michigan and nationwide?
That's a great question, Gordon. And the economy is getting better, and we're all thankful for that. Unemployment seems to be dropping, but what the figure that we really look at is household income. And so as a person goes into the workforce or they take on a second job or whatever their situation might be, they come to a place where they will walk off the financial cliff, so to speak. They won't have access to any other benefits. They won't qualify. They'll make too much money, but they won't make enough money in order to make ends meet. So that makes the service that the food banks provide across the state so critical to their continued success. So that's why we're probably delivering more food, as much as 40 million pounds of food, of produce across the state annually. And so it's being there for people kind of as the safety net to help them as they come off that financial cliff.
But the safety net still has to be part of this end result if you're going to really tackle the problem of hunger in Michigan. The safety net still has to be there and be pretty strong, doesn't it?
I believe it does. I absolutely believe it does. And as people are entering back into the workforce, as or as they're growing, or as the underemployed is finding better and paying jobs in their field of expertise, then it's very important that the over the 3,000 pantries that we have across the state served by these seven food banks, that we continue to do our mission, not only just do it, but we have to do it with excellence.
I want to read this paragraph from your op-ed. When I first accepted the position of executive director at the council, a person said to me, "So you are going to end hunger in Michigan. Well, I want you to know that hunger is not merely an access problem, but when you take on hunger, you will get poverty, structural racism, education, and housing all for free." And you say the person who advised you this, she was correct. So what are some things here that may still be sort of outside your control when you're trying to get at the big problem of hunger?
Well, I think that our approach is to build a collaborative network. We do food, and we deliver food to people who are in need of food. That's what we do. That's our contribution to this collaborative work model. Our goal is to take hunger off the table so that people are free to think about how do they achieve and better themselves and gain a bit higher quality of life that they desire. So there are strategic partners across this state that are just as good at what they're doing as we are at what we're doing. And we're finding those people. And through that collaborative work model, whether it be in housing or in civil rights or racism or in any of the areas that are contributing factors to holding people down, we're finding those people. We're having those conversations about how do we approach this together. Let us do what we do and do it very well, and let you do what you do and do it very well.
Can you tell us who some of those other groups are? I mean, have you really kind of started to forge some of these partnerships?
Well, the Department of Health and Human Services under the new director, Nick Lyon, has been very open about these conversations. And we found there are pathways to potential model with a worker being placed in the school, also being willing to be placed into the community. And so we're working with them to talk about placing some of their DHSS workers in some of our distribution points around the state. So we're very excited about that first step in the model.
So we obviously have, as we've said many times here, a big problem. So it's one that's probably not going to get solved overnight. As our listeners maybe want to follow this going forward, what are the things they might look for that tell them that there is some progress being made and that the solution is starting to come together?
I think we can find that, you know, there's probably 1.7 million people that we serve annually through the food bank network. You'll find about 91,000 volunteers across the state. So to watch the numbers in regard to the meal gap and what's the percentage of people that are food insecure, we watch that shrink over the next few years. And one of the ways that'll happen is because that number of 91,000 volunteers will grow. There'll be more people who rally to the cause, who come and say, hey, I can contribute. I want to make a difference. Let me help.
So part of what you're doing here, you want to recruit more people to serve on a volunteer basis.
Absolutely. I think all of our food banks would appreciate that work. And then also, you know, we're looking at partnerships through the school system, too. It's a fixture in the community. The building's open early. It's open late. They're serving the population in the community. We know who needs food in that population, in that community. And as we develop partnerships, we're able to find schools, superintendents across the state who are saying, hey, come work with us. We want to help you meet your goals because it serves our kids and our families that we're serving.
Philip Knight, thank you for your time.
It's been my pleasure, Gordon. Thank you for your interest.
Philip Knight is the executive director of the Food Bank Council of Michigan. A link to his column titled Hunger is Not Inevitable can be found at WMUK.org. Links with more information and longer versions of the interviews heard on West Southwest can always be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.